David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I wanted to start a series of conversations with a good friend of the show, longtime activist, freedom fighter, Kali Ankuno, who you know from Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi. Recently, Kali, along with Brian Drollett and Doug Norberg, published an in-depth piece, one that is historically relevant, gives sound analysis for where we are at the present time, and lays down some groundwork for steps we can take moving forward. The article is called Shifting Focus, Organizing for Revolution, Not Crisis Avoidance. And it is a lengthy article, but again, a must read, a very good article. It's something that I would say that everybody should look up. So I want to make sure that people definitely get a hold of it. And we're not going to be able to go through the entire thing, which is why it's going to be a series, because I think a lot of the information that you put is something that we just need to discuss one piece at a time. So let's start. The easy question for you, Kali, is why did you all write this? Who is Brian Drollett and who is Doug Norberg?
Well, many in your Bay Area audience might know Doug Norberg. Longtime activist on the scene. You might remember him for a lot of the video work that him and his wife did on the scene, recording activities from the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. Just a lot of his writings and works. And then folks would might more on the East Coast probably would know Brian Drollett from his work in the media world as well, producing movies, helped to get Democracy Now! With Amy and some other folks kind of get that off the ground. And he managed, a couple of different outlets doing media, doing small films, primarily about Palestine, the anti-war effort, following the veterans after the Iraq, wars one and two, did a couple of documentaries on that. And this piece, I've known both of them for many, many a moon. Worked, struggled with, learned from, with them going back. But this particular piece kind of starts with a film project that we have been working on for the good part of about 5 years, maybe even more. And the film project initially started with us trying to tackle the question, or just really just end this fallacious notion that America was beyond, was now a truly a multiracial democracy, that we were a post-racial society. So this shows you, this dates you where some of the stuff goes, because, just as we were kind of ramping up, finishing like a narrative in a script, this was before the days of, the rebellion in Mike Brown's name, right? Mm-hmm. The rise of Black Lives Matter. Well, just as we were ramping up to do this, and this is what, 2014 now, that blew up. So that totally disproved that argument, right? And then what we wanted to get into a deeper question was just looking at this current era, this question of why certain folks within this kind of American project, US project, why certain folks, i.e. us, Black and Brown folks, why we have to have all these special laws and special amendments, to be included. And what we really was trying to uncover and break down in a systematic way was a real exposure that, this thing called American democracy has never been democratic. It's always represented the interests of a small few, and it does so by design. So we wanted to do that. And just then again, while we were kind of ramping that up, two things hit: COVID-19. Hit, and then just to kind of clear expose of where Trump was at, totally destroying in real time in front of everybody's eyes, the basic norms and institutions of bourgeois democracy as it's practiced here in the United States. And it was our read, you know, on the heels of what I call the Floyd Rebellion in the, you know, last summer, the summer of 2020, that that historic motion was going to be contained by this effort to put everything into defeating Donald Trump and rallying around the Democratic Party, no matter who was on the ticket and no matter what the agenda was. And we wanted to just give a historic perspective that, look, we are at a deeper conjuncture. The capitalist, you know, world system, not just the United States, is fragmented, it's fracturing. And it's entering a very dangerous period where right-wing forces all over the globe are becoming ascendant, in part because they're better organized and better financed, but also in that they are offering a set of solutions which offer, at least on the surface, some short-term answers, but are not going to deal with the deep crisis of capitalism. And we wanted to point out why, and to try to provide with a historical contextualization why many of these strategies that try to harken back to the good old days of, you know, the welfare state and social democracy, why they won't work, you know, why they didn't work then and why they won't work now. And to say that we have to press forward at this critical time, why there's in many sense an opportunity to move forward with a program that has the potential, and I stress has the potential, to radically transform society and make it something that's not only about equity in the deepest sense of the word, but also about making sure that life on this planet, complex life on this planet, survives, because we have upended this kind of you know, carbon, oil-based, destructive, extractive cycle that we are on with the capitalist system that's killing life on this planet, killing us and life on this planet. So we wanted to try to offer this to kind of shake some things up, recognizing that all of that energy that was being captured in the fall, that there was going to be a deep crisis, you know, in 2021. Because if it was just only trying to regroup from the pandemic and how that altered and shifted the world economy, right, there was going to be deep structures and deep issues that we were going to have to confront, and that the solutions that Biden and the Democrats, you know, put on offer were not going to solve that crisis. And what would be our next steps? What should we do? That's what this essay in part was born from, David.
Okay, let's jump into a couple of things. I want to start off with just noting your remarks about the election. And I've heard people who I think share your viewpoint or some of your viewpoints kind of imply and sometimes directly said it was a waste of time, all this energy, people out in the streets, you know, to elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and, you know, and really would have voted for anybody other than Trump. My assessment of that is that many folks saw this rise of the strongmen. This is how you actually start off the essay, and you name mm-hmm. them off, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Duarte in the Philippines, you know, Drongo and Boris Johnson in the UK, and I forget where recently.
Modi in India.
Yeah, and right. Modi in India. So there's all these dictators, and we saw a guy here, a reality TV guy who got hoisted into the White House, move in that direction and pretty much say, this is what I want to do too. You know, let's change the law, let's flip the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. People saw a lot of ravaging on his part. And I don't think there was an illusion that Joe Biden was going to bring any sort of normalcy. And I don't think there was an illusion that he would be a good guy. In fact, people need to be reminded that his presidency, for the most part, or his candidacy, was dead until he went to South Carolina and and this is where people may have misread the tea leaves, Clyburn, James Clyburn, pretty much resurrected his career, gave all his political capital to Joe Biden and said, this is the guy. And Black folks lined up and we started to hear the words harm reduction, right? And other people said, look, we might have a couple of years, 2 or 3 years to get something together. We can push him, we can fight him. So let's kind of start with that backdrop. One, the rise of the strong men, which is how you all started off the article, and then the reality of how people were looking at what was going on in this country, Clyburn saving Joe Biden, and Black people reading that, many people reading that saying, we're going to get something for this, because if we can put these guys in the White House, they're going to be grateful. They're going to look, they're going to realize that we did them a solid. You're going to have to do us a solid back. So maybe this is the way to start this off. And understanding that I think the main goal was to avoid Trump's name being put up alongside these other strong men and being a permanent etching in stone.
Well, I would say that that's your standard narrative. I think that's absolutely correct, but it's wrong.
It's wrong in what part? It was wrong in people reading the tea leaves, or it was wrong in thinking
it's not just wrong in terms of people reading the tea leaves. It's wrong in terms of that boat has already sailed.
Okay.
You know, folks have been out organized by the right on a systematic level. Trump was just a symptom of that. You can remove Trump from the equation. And trust me, the Republicans, despite appearances, are trying to do that, right? There's many people vying to take his seat and outdo him based upon the formula and the precedent that he set. I mean, you know, the governors of, if you look at all this madness that's going on in Texas and in Florida in particular, you know, from the governors, that's a race for the president. They interviewing for the job. And they're trying to steal his base. So, you know, they're not planning on him being around forever. And Mitch McConnell and some of them, you know, who never stood him to begin with, they want him gone. And as soon as they get an opportunity, if they get an opportunity to get him out of the kind of the pole position, they will. But that doesn't mean that their agenda will stop one iota, because it ain't. Right. All this concern that folks rightly have. Let's just give an example about the abortion laws and these contests. That's the one that's being heard today, challenging the Texas law, and the piece is coming up on December 1st, I believe it is, where Roe versus Wade is being directly challenged by the state of Mississippi. They put these challenges together on the basis of a long-term, I'm talking decades-long campaign to take over the judiciary branch of government. At every level, not just at the Supreme Court level, but at every level. They've been following a plan, they've been following the script, and they've been organizing, and they are now in an institutional position to reorganize this society. So just focusing in on Trump missed the boat. And you can see that in how the limitations that Biden always clearly was going to have with the 50-50 Senate, and with shrinking fortunes in the House, where the Democrats barely have a lead. And this was going to be clear, you know, this was clear that this was going to happen long before, you know, Trump started his theatrics about not accepting the election. And people need to know, he set that framework up before he was elected in 2016. And then he ramped up his whole rhetoric at the election. If he lost at the election, would have had to have been stolen. He started that well before even this Washington Post report puts out that they kind of traced it to March of 2020, but it followed his rhetoric. He had been saying that all along, that, you know, only way I could be defeated was if they rig it. He was saying that in 2017 and 2016. So the man never lied about what his intentions were. But anyway, getting back to the critical piece of folks mixing the boat about, you have been out organized. The liberals have been thoroughly out organized, and not just in the past 4 or 5 years, but for decades, right? And that if you're going to follow that route, thinking that the executive is going to save you. Look at how they are reconstructing society on a state level. You know, one of the main campaign pieces, the long-term strategy, is doing a constitutional convention. And if they get more than 35 other states locked down where they have, you know, Republican governors and Republican-controlled legislatures, which they have in about, I think it's 31 states right now, they can call that convention and totally rewrite the Constitution. This has been a long-term agenda of theirs, and they are on, using, you know, old school big words, they're on the precipice of accomplishing that.
Let me ask you this, you Colin.
Think that a vote in Biden is going to stop that? I think you're lying to yourself.
No, I don't think people thought that. I think maybe you're right. I think
I don't think they studied it.
But let me come back to this. The organizing aspect. Mm-hmm. Two aspects to the organizing. One, there was a certain type of arrogance that you saw on both coasts, in on the East Coast and out here in the West, where people felt we got it down. We're well-funded, we're well-schooled, we made some history, we made some remark, we made some marks. We are skilled organizers, right? And I think that arrogance put people in a situation where they did not think somebody in Mississippi, somebody in Arkansas would be capable of out-organizing them. You know, somebody who's in the Christian church. So mm-hmm. let's kind of look at it on that aspect. The other aspect too, I think there was a type of strategic amplifying of rhetoric that made it almost hip and cool not to involve yourself in local situations. I don't need to worry about who's the governor. I don't need to worry about who's on school boards and all that. So many people avoided that, like the plague. And I mean, I know that from being on the ground, you know, going to places like in Houston, Harris County, the work we did there, you know, 80% turnout in 08, come back a year later, you know, you could barely get people to come. And rhetoric was like, man, they don't talk to me. I don't talk to them. I ain't going to vote. It don't matter. And you started to see these pieces get put together where we're seeing, you know, a virtual tyranny of the majority. So let's deal with those two aspects, the arrogance of organizing when folks, as you said, have been at this for a long time. And now we're seeing that there might not be a viable answer.
Well, I think, let me shift it up just a little bit, Debbie, because people are searching for answers within the system. Mm-hmm. And the system is designed to do what it does, right? And if you stay within the rules of the game, you're always going to be behind, and you're always going to be in playing catch up. Because the way this particular system is designed, in many respects, it's not about numbers, it's about territory, it's about land, right? Numbers don't really decide kind of federal elections in the United States.
But they do on local level.
On a local level, municipal and county level, yeah. You know, maybe even a state level to a certain
and that's with a majority. So that was the bait and switch. The bait and switch was to get everybody to focus on those presidential elections and ignore everything like school board and dog catcher and, you know,
the local thing. The right has made is primarily the advances, you know, since the beginning of the Goldwater Revolution. Barry Goldwater, for folks who don't, you know who ran for president in 64, you know, started this kind of hard right revolution. That Trump and all the rest of these folks are still following in. But once they were soundly defeated, they recognized that they needed to build a base. And what they did over a long period of time, we're talking 60 something years now, they first and foremost concentrated on winning and redefining the local, right? And then the county and then the state, and took those over, you know, piece by piece by piece and run their agenda. And they covered the map. They covered the spread, right? And that is what, you know, Democrats who just normally look at, you know, large, you know, kind of demographic shifts and demographic trends, never really concentrated on that. And let's break down why they didn't concentrate on that. It's not just because of willful ignorance. The Democrats don't want to be responsible to the actual needs of the coalition that they have constructed.
Can you repeat that again?
Democrats do not want to be accountable to the actual coalition that they have constructed, basically that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, constructed since World War II. They don't want to answer to what Black people really want and need. They don't want to answer to what Indigenous people really want and need. They don't want to answer to what women really want and need, right? And every time we bring up some core fundamental pieces of our agenda, as it were, within this framework, it always gets blocked under the premise that you are asking too much, or that will require us to do at minimum a major redistribution of the wealth in this society to suit your needs and to create social programs that they clearly don't want to create, right? A Manchin is not alone in saying, I don't want an entitlement society. Who is he really talking about? What is he talking about, right?
Talking about Joe Manchin.
Talking about us.
Yeah.
Right. He's talking about us and dealing with our needs for adequate housing, adequate health care, adequate education. You know, these are things that have been on the agenda being demanded by Black and Brown folks for decades and have never been in any fundamental way addressed by the Democrats, other than to say, well, we're just going to let the market determine, you know, the best allocation of resources. That is their solution. And basically offer you another version of Reaganism. We're going to let, you know, the economy lift all boats by just creating more opportunity. That is their rhetoric. That is their program. And so they really do not want full participation of our communities and our people because they cannot answer for the, you know, to meet our needs. That is the fundamental basis.
Long time ago, we talked about this, and maybe you can weigh in on this again. When Obama ran in 08, it looked like he did something that he wasn't supposed to do in this regard. There was a set number of people that usually voted. And whether with a written or unwritten agreement, that's who you all went. That's who these candidates usually try to appeal to. You know, just to paint a picture, the right would go for the blue collar workers and the left would go for the soccer moms, that type of deal, right? Mm-hmm. And when he came along, he said, you know, there's a bunch of people outside of these boxes that haven't voted. So let me go excite them. Those are, you know, infrequent voters was the word that was used in 2007 when he started running, right? Young people, first time voters. And when he went to, you know, when he ran, he cashed in on that history. I'm making history. So people's like, I never voted before, but I am now, right? And these were people I think that you're talking about that said, I have some reasonable expectations. We're making history. Let's continue with history. He allowed himself to be aligned with or allowed himself to be pictured with Dr. King. And so people felt Dr. King was about poor people. You'll be about poor people. And I'm just painting this picture because you got a sinking feeling that once he got on the stage that he was going to serve another master. And it was hard for many of us to believe it until we saw.
Anybody who would have studied him and his program and his history would have known that. But he did, he did one hell of a salesman job.
Yes.
He did, you know, and even then, I think folks should have examined that better. Remember, his key slogan going into 08 was change you can believe in. What the hell does that mean? Change that you can believe in, right? Not the change you want. So I'm going back to my earlier point. Not the change you want, not the change that you need, but change that you can believe in. Things, we're going to keep this within the bounds of this limited Republican, you know, Republic framework and you know, what it will allow, you know, folks to deliberate on and make decisions on. at best you get some redistribution pieces. And what they floated out is you know, part of their main piece was that, you know, they were going to revive Hillary Clinton's, and let's be clear about who that was, Hillary Clinton's healthcare program, the bill that she tried to get passed in the mid-90s, you know, they were going to revive that to create national healthcare, right? And then off the top killed a single-payer option, right? Universal healthcare, and just left it to the market.
Right.
Right. When the need is for universal health care.
Right.
And then the other thing that they had promised was they were going to change all, you know, a set of laws to make it easier for labor, you know, to organize and get itself gathered to defeat some of the limitations that have been imposed upon it over the years from Taft-Hartley, et cetera. And then, you know, they were promising things in all corners. I can keep going on. But those are some of the main things. And it was all little points of redistribution, right? Which, and we need to be clear, redistribution by way of tax measures does not change who holds and owns the means of production and therefore power in this society. And if we really want to change this society, we're going to have to, A, do a massive redistribution of land, i.e. a decolonization program, and totally change the means of production. Who owns it? Who controls it? Who determines what's produced and why? What resources are extracted? And to do that in a broad democratic fashion, well, we are deliberating on that on a day-to-day or week-to-week or month-to-month or whenever the need requires. That is how you transform this society, not just saying, well, you know, because y'all protested at my office and I don't want y'all to burn things down, I'll come up with an agreement which says, you know, I was giving you $2, but now I'll give you $4. Y'all gonna be cool. That's the program that social change has fundamentally followed in this society. I don't care what issue you look at it, of how it's been negotiated and how the folks who have power and have had power since this country started as a settler colonial project, how they maintain it. That's all that's on the agenda, right? And that was the change that we can believe in. And it worked for, you know, a good minute. And then once it became clear that Obama, like most of the Democrats the last 60 years, you know, what they've been basically touting is stick with me because these Goldwater cats or these Republican cats, you know, they will destroy everything. Meanwhile, every 2 years, and particularly every 4 years, they mediate a program of saving the empire. I'm talking about the Democrats, mm-hmm. right? Like, we're not going to fracture this. We're not going to break it. In the name of not fracturing, not breaking it, we're going to make some compromises with the right, right? So that they just don't go buck wild crazy. And this society has moved to the right steadily ever since.
Right.
Right. So if you really looked at it objectively, you know, many of the programs that Obama pushed were to the right of what Reagan was pushing. I mean, we got to be real if we're going to have a real serious analysis, but it shows to the degree to which we have been conditioned not to accept a massive overhaul of society along the lines of, say, the new society program of creating all the different educational and healthcare things that had been on the agenda. Remember, national healthcare had been on the agenda since the 60s, right? Even earlier, really, but there was a major attempt at that and full equality and equity for women. That all that stuff had been on the agenda since the 60s, got delayed in the 70s and 80s, and then started to have a resurrection in the 90s, and then had some level of fulfillment finally, at least on the healthcare piece, in the 2000s. But those things have been on the agenda, but have been basically gutted step by step by the Democrats' steady march to the right under this program of compromising with the Republicans, because the Democratic Party, Obama and Biden in particular, embodies this the most. His primary objective is saving the union. And if that means giving the right more and more of what they want, that is fundamentally what the Democrats, at least that wing of the Democratic Party, will do.
Wow. It sounds like Abe Lincoln all over again, huh?
That's Look, people need to go back. You've heard me say this before. I'm going to say it again. If folks really want to have a deep understanding of what has been going on, I would say particularly the last 10 years, if not the last 20 years, you need to read W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction in America.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent book to do that. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Kali Nkuno. And I think for this essay that you all laid out, you started really going in on the very first chapter, which is Defending Democracy is a Dead End. So as we're speaking today, there's big elections around the country, in particular, a lot of spotlight on Virginia. Mm-hmm. And the hope is that if Terry McAuliffe can win, then maybe we're on the way to saving democracy. We had a gentleman on the other day who pointed out that it was under Terry McAuliffe, who was the governor, that Charlottesville happened, and he did nothing. This goes back to your point. You don't satisfy the needs of the people. You would actually not even realize that he was the governor. He was so absent when these things happen. But with that being said, let's say the Democrats do pull it out. Let's say they do win Virginia. People are going to be hopeful and feel like we're on the path. Kali, we're on the path. We're going to save this democracy. We're going to turn it around. But you're laying out, gosh, in about 4 or 5 pages, that it's a dead end. What are key highlights you want people to take from that? What, I think you started on some of it, but what are the other aspects that make this a dead end proposition?
Well, number one, if he wins, what can he deliver? Just ask yourself that question, anybody who's listening. You know, anywhere in the national audience, Hard Rock has a national audience, not just a Bay Area one. You know,
we can have a continued study of Black history because, you know, the new governor, if he comes in, wants to get rid of all that, no critical race theory.
Critical race theory taught in American schools now anyway.
Oh no, they redefined it. We know that. They redefined it. It's a euphemism for Black history and ethnic studies. So
I mean, yeah, I'm just saying, but even still, that ain't taught in American schools anyway. And the part of curriculum that does exists because of the social struggles from the 1960s, 70s, and on to the 80s, and even a little bit in the 90s, right? Black activist forces acted primarily on local levels, created a national curriculum kind of agenda, you know, particularly in the 80s and 90s, and struggled for there to be a broader inclusion of the curriculum. But again, that happened first and foremost on local levels, right? And folks need to remember that. And I'm saying that, you know, because again, what can he deliver? That if you want to kind of wage that battle, you're going to have to go to your local school board and battle that out, right? And take over those institutions, because that's largely determined at the county level and at the district level. But folks are looking for these solutions from the top because they are not doing the work at the base to transform the society. Again, being out organized. Right. And if you want something much more radical, then you're going to have to actually create the institutions at the grassroots level to actually carry that out and execute it. But thinking that you're going to continue to have Biden or McAuliffe or somebody from on high come in and save you because you have invested them with some executive power to make certain critical decisions, that in the long term is a losing strategy. It doesn't actually build your capacity should something go wrong, to either challenge him or to come up with something different or something new. And one of the deep problems I would argue that we have is we are settling for this representational system rather than actually building our own capacity, right, to govern ourselves and to govern our communities. And I come from a notion in the tradition that we put this in is that, look, the left, you know, of which I see myself as a representative of, our function in the role is to actually challenge a democracy, but that doesn't mean we in any form or fashion have to uplift or praise or defend the institutions of bourgeois community. We can create democratic institutions, dual power institutions, as many folks are calling them, in our own communities. And we have to do that. If we're going to crown it the right in any fundamental way, and the real life-threatening challenges that it's posing to many of our communities, you know, we're going to have to start with being able to take care of ourselves on some basic level with food and food security, and then do a real level of self-defense. Like, that is where we're at. People better not elude themselves that we're someplace else.
Right. You said here, you all wrote, you, Doug and Robert, if I'm correct with the names.
Ryan.
Ryan, thank you. Wrote that fascism is one of the many variants of governance in the capitalist world system. You also talked about that capitalism adapts. It doesn't die, it just adapts. And it also, you talked about there's a incorrect assumption that there are normative political relations and normative systems of government within a capitalist world system. How do you break that down for us? What does that mean?
It means capitalism is going to preserve itself, using one of our movement phrases, by any means necessary, right? And when and where it could allow a rights framework, you know, allowing a few folks to think that they have some decision over how things go, i.e. bourgeois democracy, they'll enable that. But when and where, they just need to put the hammer down, you know, and get folks to fall in line and comply and do the business of making, you know, profits for them, they'll institute that, right? And we see this on a global level, but we also see it on a local level. You know, so one of the things we need to draw out, right, is there's all this framework. You hear it on NBC and CNN every day, all day, right? Trump is threatening democracy, or the Republicans are threatening democracy. You got to step back and remind yourself. And they be talking about bipartisanship, right? Well, the Republic used to be bipartisan. Go back and remember that, you know, most Black folks in this country couldn't vote until 1964.
Right.
So this period of this grand, you know, we had bipartisanship, we had, you know, a functioning democracy. What are you really talking about? You're talking about an apartheid state. You're talking about a hair-invoked democracy that only worked for a few. And if that's what you're holding up and that's what you're trying to go back to, then objectively, you're on the same course of where Donald Trump and the Republicans are. Because what they're just saying openly, I want to go back to the 1950s, right? Where Negroes knew their place, where Mexicans and Chicanos and Chinese knew their place in society. They rode on the back of the bus. They didn't speak unless they were spoken to. Stayed off the sidewalk if a white person was walking on the sidewalk, said yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, and they worked for minimum wages. That's what they're trying to go back to. So you harken back to this notion that, you know, you're trying to save this golden edifice. When did this democracy ever exist? When did this, you know, pristine, everybody got a chance to decide when in this country has that ever existed? It's a figment of both of their imaginations that they're trying to perpetrate on us. And we don't need to fall for it.
Let me come back to the point that you made in regards to saving democracy. You emphasized in these essays that we're going to have to do things locally. We're going to have to control things locally and work that way. The challenge that you have, because you use the word apartheid, and we see this in places where you do have authoritarian regimes, you start to act, you can be outlawed in a certain way. And let me kind of bring this into focus. You know, since we went back to W.E.B. Du Bois, the big debate that he had, the beef that he had with Booker T was like, don't worry about that. Don't worry about the government or any of that. Let us just learn a trade and economically we'll be good. But it was around that time that they started coming after us as Black people and destroying everything that we economically put together from Tulsa to Rosewood on down. So it seems like, and Du Bois was like, we need to challenge the government. We need to have some say, so et cetera, et cetera. We need to be recognized as citizens and have these rights. Are you kind of taking the best of both people and then, you know, and moving forward with that? Or are we really just ignoring the fact that if somebody gets into a power position, they could make it unlawful, you know, for us to do some very basic things locally or nationally?
They're already let's start with the reality, right? Not as the, as we wish things to be or want them to be, but what they are. Mm-hmm. And they are already doing that. Since 2014, everywhere, all throughout the country, they're making protests unlawful, right? And if you just look from 2014 on, all the different laws have been erected, even in California, to limit people's ability to protest and to take certain forms of direct action. They've made it illegal to run folks over down if you standing in the street, right? In numerous states, they've erected a whole new surveillance system. They've made progressive improvements on since 2001. They've targeted political ideology, particularly now. The latest biggest craze is going after Antifa, which stands for anti-fascist forces, with a number of different laws in the books in a number of different states. So they're already criminalizing dissent, and we need to recognize, I think, to your point, challenging this piece of a necessity is going to make core forces that challenge it outlaws. Right? Because trying to change the order fundamentally is against the law. We need to understand that and recognize that. And that, again, the capitalist system and those who mediate its control, through government or who do its bidding, they're going to do everything they can to protect the status quo, right? To protect relations as they are. And those of us who want to change that, we're going to be criminalized. And this is a lesson we need to get folks to really hone in on. And I would say, look, we need to listen to some of the comrades who are just got out. Maroon Schultz, just got out on compassionate release. Go and study him and his history. David Gilbert just released another. These are political prisoners and prisoners of war that I'm talking about, right? From our liberation movements from the 60s and 70s, when they were primarily active in their communities, organizing and struggling. Jaleel Muntakim just did a tribunal that happened, over the last week, really trying to challenge this and with a broader coalition of forces, but, bringing him in as he was one of the central forces, and Jaleel was and remains, I think, one of our movement's most valuable intellectual thinkers of trying to challenge the field. But I'm bringing them into this equation so that folks learn what this system will do when it feels pressed, when it feels challenged, and what hammers they will bring down. And remember, most of them, these folks that I just mentioned, most of them, not all of them, but Jaleel and Russell Maroon, they were in prison during the time of Nixon and his law and order campaign were on the heels of, what happened in the 1960s, he came under, that was the main title of his program in 67, 68. I'm gonna restore law and order. Same rhetoric that Donald Trump has been using, and if you peep it on the same level, Biden used a certain aspect of that. I'm with protest, but only the protest that I want to sanction, i.e. protest that doesn't challenge social relationships, and most importantly, don't challenge property rights or in any form or fashion. So if you do that and stay compliant, then I'll support you. If you do that, then I'm going to criminalize you. I'm going to, throw the hammer at you. And that was a shot directly aimed at the George Floyd rebellion and the forces, engaged in the overall, movement for Black lives. That was very clear. So do we need to be concerned about them bringing the hammer down? Absolutely. Can we ignore the state? No, we cannot. That's a critical piece that I think we try to bring home. In this piece where you're talking about combining the best of, to use a kind of a Black nationalist framework, are we trying to combine the best of Du Bois and Booker T. Washington? Absolutely. I think I've tried to define my entire practice within building upon the legacy of the Black liberation movement with all its contradictions and complexities and trying to say, hey, this is where, to use those two so folks are familiar with this conversation, this is what Booker T. got right. But he also got this wrong. This is what Du Bois got right. But he also got this wrong. Right. And going back to Black Reconstruction is in part, so folks understand, that work, Booker T, was when he wrote that, was 1935. So it's in the midst of the Great Depression. And he's having some serious arguments within the NAACP that, you know, look, we are not doing enough in the midst of Black folks losing millions of acres of land, right? And that's what was going on during the Great Depression. Black folks, so folks know, own more land in this, you know, empire before the Great Depression than we do now or at any other point in time in history here. So folks right. understand that. And so what Du Bois in part was arguing for, look, there's an element of self-reliance and do for self that we need to make sure that we stick with. Not that we, you know, necessarily elevate, but he was seeing all of that work that had been built up basically since the 1860s, right, on the heels of emancipation, all the different things that Black folks had self-organized disappearing before his eyes and saying we need to both protect it and extend that under these conditions, not in some compliant way, but in a radical transformative way. And large parts of that, the Black Reconstruction is actually a nod to Booker T to say Booker T got some things right. And just because I was arguing with him that we should ignore the state because it's sure enough in hell ain't ignoring us, right. People misread what I was saying to be like, I was against his program of economic uplift and self-organization and self-reliance, when in fact I was not. I wanted it to be articulated in a way that wouldn't recreate the dynamics of inequality within our own community because people organize along capitalist lines as opposed to cooperative lines. Hmm. That was what Du Bois was trying to correct and saying, no, I had an agenda all along, and this crisis that we are facing, this would be in the Great Depression, is I want to bring out in a deeper sense, what are the contradictions in this society that still have to be worked out? And the fundamental piece that he was challenging was that the Reconstruction was always going to be limited because it did not get at the capitalist roots of this society and challenging that. It left capitalist relations in place, and therefore it was going to put Black and other, you know, folks who labor need to be extracted back in their place, and we still there. Those fundamental right. contradictions ain't been resolved yet.
And I think a perfect example where what you're saying played out is South Africa. What you just lined out is what we saw with the ANC when they ran to power, and and there you have it.
Yep. You mean Cyril Ramaphosa, the richest yeah. Black man in the country, is now the president of the country. And he is instituting a massive law and order campaign, even using that rhetoric. So folks need to study, you know, these dynamics, right? And how capital functions. And that's a different, that's also a piece that we are trying to reassert in this piece, in this shifting focus piece, is going back and trying to get folks to look, like really pay attention to understand these dynamics. You know, what is the falling rate of profit? Why is that important? You know, right. how is that structuring certain dynamics of reality? Why is that leading to capital to make certain kind of political choices, desperate choices? Why is it leading it, you know, to support all these programs, which, again, you know, try to control labor, keep it from organizing, keep it from amassing any form of power to challenging it. And it's not just doing that here in the United States, it's doing that globally because the system is a global one. And all the responses and the challenges move on a global level. And that is how we need to think. So it's not just, you know, this piece is not just telling folks, hopefully people are grounded in it. Yes, we got to do our local work. Yes, we got to do the base building piece that's necessary, but it has to be in tune with the dynamics that are happening on a global level. And we need to understand what's happening on the global level. We need to have a clear understanding of, you know, what's the impact of the millions of farmers in India organizing and rising up and challenging Modi, right? What is the impact of some of the massive labor strikes and coordinated stuff we've been seeing inside of China? How does that impact you? Because it does, right? It impacts your very bottom line in terms of, you know, the consumer items that you consume, but also the wage structure you have to negotiate and live under here in the United States or anywhere else on the planet, because this capital operates on the global level. And when and where it gets challenged, what it has been doing very successfully, particularly the last 60 years, all right, you know, these folks are demanding too much in terms of wages in the United States. So I'm gonna shift production to, you know, Haiti, to Mexico, you know, to South Korea. And then when the folks in South Korea rise up, which they've been doing, South Korea has a very dynamic labor movement. When they rise up, all right, well, look, I'll just shift that to Indonesia, or I'll shift that to South Africa or Nigeria. And then when they get organized, they keep moving, right, and keep setting terms. And you see this play out, how that desperate they are. I know we run out of time, but how desperate they are. One of the things that Biden and the G20 just went and negotiated, it ain't going to last, but it was an interesting attempt of saying that they're going to cap the tax rates, at least within the G20 nations, that all corporations are going to have to pay at minimum 15% tax. And what they're trying to do is in part stall the race to the bottom of countries like Ireland or Iceland or the Bahamas or Caicos and the Turks, saying, all right, or hell, now North Dakota and Delaware, saying, you know, come here, we won't tax you. You know, set up your business operations here. You know, we won't tax you. So they're trying to evade that to kind of stabilize markets, but it's not going to work.
Right. Let me do this. We've been talking with Kali Nkuno. If you're just tuning in, we haven't even begun to touch the surface. We just got through maybe the first couple of chapters of this incredible article that we want people to read. Tell people the article, where they can find it, and then we're going to have you come back and we'll dig deeper into some of the other aspects, Kali.
Yeah, I mean, the article is called Shifting Folks. Organizing for Revolution, Not Crisis Avoidance. And this is
say that one more time again. Shifting Focus.
Shifting for Focus. Organizing for Revolution, Not Crisis Avoidance.
And where can we find it?
Right now you can find it on Navigating the Storm blogspot. We are looking to get it published. I think a Black Agenda Report will have it up, I think, later this week. Hopefully monthly review online. We'll have it up later on this week. But for now, you can grab it at Navigating the Storm.
And so I just want to let people know, when we have you come back, one of the things that you talk about, that you all talk about, is the adaptability of capitalism. You have the dynamics of capital make the illusion of democracy just that, an illusion. And then I think one of the more important pieces is concession in the wake of a revolution. It's interesting. I played a little snippet of a speech the other day from H.R.A.P. Brown, where he talked about confusing concessions with progress. And so we're gonna, you know, like we said, this is not something that we can cover all in one swoop. We're gonna have you come back and we're gonna dig into these other aspects. But in the meantime, people should take a look at Navigating the Storm or Black Agenda Report later this week, so they can read it in its entirety, and that will, you know, keep us informed and we can go and dwell deeper. So Kali Nkuno from Cooperation Jackson, thank you for joining us this afternoon and giving us a whole lot to focus on.
Always a pleasure, brother, and looking forward to the next piece.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio, folks.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.